The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. This week, we'll have more from my interview with Judy Chang, Executive Director of the International Network of People Who Use Drugs. Loyal listeners will recall that we heard part one last week. But first, in the 2020 general election, the state of Oregon overwhelmingly approved Measure 110, the Drug Addiction Treatment and Recovery Act. I spoke recently with Tara Hurst, Executive Director of the Oregon Health Justice Recovery Alliance, for an update. Let's get to the other part of Measure 110 for a moment. The one that got a lot of attention, let's face it, and that's decriminalizing simple possession. I mean, the fact is law enforcement wastes a lot of time and resources pursuing low-level possession offenses. In a lot of instances, it's just harassment. They're not able to do that as much now in Oregon. Is that correct?
That's correct. So basically, if you have a small possession, personal possession of drugs in your pocket, you at most will get a citation from an officer. And hopefully as these networks are built up, you'll also get a kind of, here's some folks that you can go see if you feel like you need support. They will no longer get a criminal record, which creates, you know, long-term barriers like access to housing, employment, student loans, bank accounts, kind of everything we all understand as critical to lead a successful life. And so what we see is that we used to arrest 9,000 people in Oregon and for drug possession. Now there was 1,800, I believe, citations last year in 2021 when the law started, which means that thousands of people do not have barriers on their records. And now it's always hard to prove what might have happened, but we have 50 years of harm that has happened for folks with these barriers on their records and the accumulative impact on families, on communities, on, you know, access to wealth and generational wealth. So we do know what it would look like. And we're finally moving away from that. And so, you know, yes, there's the less opportunities of interactions with law enforcement when you see some of the high profile, devastating deaths by law enforcement. A lot of them were drug related. And so those, our hope is that we're minimizing, if not eliminating, those interactions.
Now, let's turn to the crisis that is currently gripping the entirety of Turtle Island and Aslan. That's the land we now call North America and the nations currently referred to as Canada and the United States. For nearly a decade now, toxins such as fentanyl, carfentanyl, other analogs have been contaminating the unregulated drug supply, been driving overdose deaths across North America to record levels. We had more than 100,000 people in the U.S. die in 2021 because of a toxic, unregulated drug supply and drug overdose. The death rate from the toxic drug supply and overdose in Canada has been even higher than in the U.S. Decriminalizing simple possession is going to help, but there is so much more that needs to be done. Up in Canada, they've seen a number of innovative approaches. Some have been endorsed by the local, provincial, and or national governments. Some have not. Community members and grieving parents are united in demanding real change. The province of BC, British Columbia, has been granted an exemption to allow limited decriminalization of unregulated drugs, only up to 2.5 grams in total of all drug, of whatever illegal combined, will be allowed, which advocates point out is much too small an amount. On the other hand, it's an important first step, and the symbolism of that move, you know, should not be lost. BC was in many respects following the lead of Oregon, and though it is much more limited, Canada's parliament even considered a decriminalization bill this session, Bill C-216. It failed to make it past the second reading, but activists are determined to keep trying. I attended a conference recently that was held by an organization in Canada called Moms Stop the Harm. And I got to tell you, the resolve of the attendees to keep working on decriminalizing, on establishing safe consumption sites, on securing safe supply. I mean, it was inspiring. It's tremendously moving. I'm starting to tear up. Sorry, long-winded intro for a very short question. Apologies. But you know, a lot of the places around the continent, around the world, are looking at Oregon's example as proof that it is possible for rational, intelligent drug policies to actually be enacted. Do you have any thoughts that you'd want to share with folks outside Oregon who are trying to save lives by changing these bad laws and ending the prohibition?
And I think it's the same advice of what we would give Oregon versus all of the other folks who are working on this. I just recently spoke to a CBC reporter out of Toronto, I believe, who is doing a story on safe supply and the decriminalization and kind of the different responses to criminalization and access. And it was really exciting to see Oregon included in that story finally. You know, and in the United States, because you look at the harms that we've done, especially when it comes to incarceration, and you look at, 108,000 people, it's easy to throw out statistics. And when we think about what we've just been through with COVID, you get kind of desensitized to what that means. But as a mom myself, if something were to happen to my son, it would be the only thing that I would want to focus on. And because it has happened to so many people's kids and loved ones, you know, I think we all should be resolved. This is a preventable death. It's not like some others that are not preventable. These are preventable deaths. These are devastating. And they deserve the dignity and the discussion and real change that any other, you know, devastating pandemic should get. So I think for any place, the important piece, and we saw this out of Portugal and others, is make sure you're in it for the long haul. This is not a quick fix, right? And people are already saying that Measure 110 isn't working or whatever that they want to say because they didn't support it in the first place. And, you know, it's ludicrous to decide if a law is working in a year. That's just not a component. It's not a viable argument. And so I think that people really need to come into this work recognizing that this is a long-term solution. The drug war was waged for 50 years longer, and to think that we can turn it around in a year it's just not rational. So I would say, like, for anybody that's working on this, you know, yeah, 2.5 per possession is small, and some point we really are in a space where people can only tolerate incrementalism, but some of that incrementalism can be really powerful. And if it saves one life or 100 lives, then it's absolutely worth it. And you can't put a price tag on that, on whether or not, you know, we should have done it. So I think that, you know, making sure that you are really committed to seeing it through all the way through, and maybe there needs to be tweaks along the way, that's fine. But what Oregon is seeing is that we are putting less barriers on folks. And, you know, that initial $30 million that we invested, 16,000 people were able to receive supports because of Measure 110. That's a staggering amount of people. 16,000 people, 60% of those folks were getting harm reduction services. And we do hear critics try to shove away the importance of harm reduction, which is interesting because when you start looking at the national conversation, luckily harm reduction is becoming more central and key as a true service that is critical in kind of working towards the overdose deaths and HIV and hepatitis C and making sure that people don't die from these preventable diseases. And so I think that, you know, when you look at the money that we've put in, you see how many people have been served. I heard a statistic that 1 in 30 overdoses result in death. And we know just from two organizations over a short couple months, they were able to reverse over 600 overdoses, which means that That is, I was terrible in math, but that's probably close to what, 20 people's lives saved that would have been added to Oregon's overdose deaths. And those are families that don't have to bury their loved ones. That is worth it. And so that's what we're working on. Those are the pieces that you have to hold on to. And that's what gives me so much hope when you think about that was 10% of the funds. 16,000 people receive services with 10% of the funds. And that's because we have the most incredible providers who know what to do. They just need the funds to do it. And so, you know, getting rid of this bureaucratic tape, making sure that people can have access to the funds that they need, it's so important, and it's what's about to happen. And I think people just need to have patience. And if you can't have patience, then you just have no business doing policy.
On the one hand, people will say, well, they should just stop using. Yeah, well, no immediate miracles, all right? And expand treatment. Great. But what about people who don't actually have a substance use disorder, who simply got hold of tainted drugs, on a toxic drug supply? Not everyone who's using happens to have an addiction problem. Not everybody who uses a substance has a substance use disorder.
I think that it's also important. It goes back to that conversation of kind of self-determination. Let me choose what is right for my body. And that goes further than just reproductive health. That goes to the very core of, if we don't trust people to make decisions for their well-being and for their own person, then what are we doing? And so what we're telling people who use substances and who use drugs is that if you don't stop, then there's something morally wrong with you. And the stigma and the shame can propel somebody from a very recreational use to a more medicated use, because there's so much shame around these conversations in our society. So really lifting that shame, recognizing that there are people who can use substances very safely and very effectively, and they don't go down the same dark holes that I did. We are not all the same people, and we need to give people the opportunity to make choices for themselves. And, you know, we have a real hard time with that with some things.
Tell me about the Health Justice Recovery Alliance and the work you're doing. I mean, it is much more than just looking at agency funding, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So it depends on the phase of implementation that we're in. But what we do is really work with providers on the ground, understand what their needs are, hear their concerns and stories, and really try to bring those to places of power, and make sure that folks are having a voice at the table where the decisions are being made. And that can look very different. We were part of the legislative work groups that created Senate Bill 755 in the 21 session, which really added a lot of detail and important components to Measure 110. We also have been part of trying to help folks apply for these funds. So a lot of people don't have access to development people or grant writers or budget or, you know, you name it, because they've been working on such a small limited budget, and they're so devoted to just making sure that the services are able to be provided that they oftentimes aren't able to build up their own businesses. So Health Justice Recovery Alliance worked with, you know, about 15 consultants in the grant writing space and nonprofit consultancy space to really support some of these providers who asked for help to either apply for these funds or to just help with creating a budget, a work plan, whatever the case is. So that was not something that we anticipated as part of the implementation of Measure 110, but I think it's important, you know, as we're asking voters and folks who live in Oregon to be patient and flexible, we also have to be flexible and hear what the needs are in the community and then adapt to that. And I'm really proud of the work that we get to do to be able to meet those needs the best we can in a way that is meaningful to these providers. I can't I can't say enough about the folks that we work with and the providers we work with. They have seen some of the most heartbreaking and experienced some of the most heartbreaking, you know, situations that most of us don't have to deal with on a daily basis in our jobs, but losing clients due to overdose, watching people, you know, trying to set people up with housing and then not being able to find them anymore because they don't have the access to the funds that they need. So it's really our job to make sure that we're, when it's necessary, being loud and pushing back against the systems that start operating the way that systems always operate. I don't know that it's intentional. It's the way they've been designed. And so when you try and change a design, if you don't fully change it, it's going to always snap back. And we do have a racist design and, you know, that does not center communities most impacted when it comes to getting their services funded. And so it's our job to make sure that those are the communities that are getting the money. Those are the communities that are being heard when it comes to solutions and how to make sure moving forward is, you know, in a way that's really honoring their needs. So that's what HJRA has been doing. We're looking towards the 2023 session, legislative session, and hoping that we can kill any bad ideas out there and just keep those funds going. You know, in the 2022 session, it was just 5 weeks. There was three major attempts at taking the money from anywhere from $30 million to $120 million every 2 years out of the services and into law enforcement, which is the opposite of what the voters intended. So it's really, it's kind of operating on all spaces. I also think it's our job to make sure that people understand that treatment does have a much broader definition and for us to help reduce the stigma of people who use drugs.
That was from my interview with Tara Hurst, Executive Director of the Oregon Health Justice Recovery Alliance. Find them on the web at healthjusticerecovery.org. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh.
You have to be high as hell to fly a kite in a thunderstorm. Ben Franklin smoked all the weed. He invented bifocals. He just showed up. Ooh, I made these. Look. Ooh. It's like a kaleidoscope. The national bird is the bald eagle. What bird did Ben Franklin want for the national bird? Turkey. Stoner. Ben, the eagle flies graceful, free, and majestic above the clouds. Yeah, but you can eat a turkey, brother.
Now let's hear the second half of my interview with Judy Cheng, Executive Director of the International Network of People Who Use Drugs. Tell listeners about some of your work at the UN.
Yeah, I mean, we work with, you know, across a range of kind of multilateral spaces, platforms, and forums, right? Because, I mean, drug use, drug policy intersects with, you know, all kinds of issues, other issues as well. So, of course, yeah, there's the Global Drug Policymaking Forum, which is the Commission on Narcotic Drugs, which we attend, you know, every year. And I think the trajectory of INPD's involvement has definitely, I think, changed over time, you know, at the beginning, and doesn't mean it won't go back, but at the beginning, you know, there was a lot of actions like right outside the UN buildings where they are making the policy, you know, calling for a global end to the global war on drugs, calling for peace, those kind of actions. I think over time, we've also like are now tracking and being in those rooms and, you know, getting involved also, like running our own side events, getting involved in shaping some of the resolutions, you know, lobbying member states, so all that kind of stuff. But I also think, yeah, we've, you know, every year before the CND, we also meet as a community, and we've also talked about, you know, also going back to some of that more direct action, you know, that campaigning in the lead up, right? Because, you know, in one sense is trying to influence, you know, the suits in the room who are making the decisions, but they're also influenced, of course, by public, you know, perception. And, you know, how do we kind of balance that, you know, name and shame, with also, you know, sometimes you have to relation build and, like, you know, influence people from within. So I think, you know, we need a range of tactics to do what we do, or, you know, to achieve what we want to achieve. But beyond the C&D, we also engage a lot with the HIV and global health spaces. And actually, you know, those are much more open actually to community engagement, because, like, through that we're linked to a whole other range of communities as well, right, that intersect a lot with people who use drugs, say people living with HIV, sex workers, gay and bisexual men, transgender communities. So I think in those health spaces, having those communities, like, come together and us working in solidarity, I also feel like we're able to have a stronger and more united voice. So, you know, we also participate twice a year in the board of UNAIDS. And also we have, like, community members on the board of the Global Fund, which is, you know, a $14 billion financing organization for the three diseases, HIV, TB and malaria. So we found those spaces actually so much more open to civil society and community engagement, because they actually have seats on their governance board, right, for, you know, reserved for communities that are most directly impacted, whereas the global drug policy space does not have that yet. And, you know, other UN agencies outside of, like, the HIV space don't have that either, though I think things are kind of slowly changing, but it's still very slow, right? There's still a lot of, like, a lot of frontiers to challenge and push on.
But still, you managed to get a seat. You're actually managing to take a seat at the table, which is really inspiring. I mean, in a lot of ways, it's really inspiring. I've listened to the CND, watch the proceedings, the main plenary webcast every year, and try to keep up. And this last couple of years, it's been, I mean, I hate to say thank goodness for COVID, but they've been webcasting so much more of the the proceedings. I mean, it's they still don't keep an archive of the plenaries. I mean, that's one of the reasons I record them every year and even broadcast some of them on the show, because they don't post these things. It's the 21st century. I'm pretty sure they have server space. They have a YouTube account. Yeah. I mean,
No, totally. But they always find ways to, you know, shut people out as much as possible. I think, you know, when they go to debate the resolutions, et cetera, or debate decision points, you know, they will move it to internal to shut out people. And still, I mean, INPD still does not have, like, ECOSOC status, right? So we can't even officially go in the CND. We have to, like, use other badges and, you know, kind of rely on the goodwill of other people to actually get in there. We've been blocked for a few years running now, which is frustrating.
I was talking to someone about that not long ago, in fact. That's do you have any, what are the kind of projects do you have going on?
Yeah, we always have a lot going on, which is super overwhelming, but I think it just highlights, like, how big the problem is of drug policy and how much there is to fight on so many different fronts. But one project we've been working on, which I think is really exciting, but also because I think it's a really exciting project in and of itself, but I think it's because it also comes from like our participation in global decision making, right? So a project that we're working on, it's called Our Body, Everybody's Rights, and it's related to the global AIDS targets, because there was a global AIDS strategy launched in 2021, and we were involved, like, in the process of developing it, which meant that, you know, inputs were sought from us. We were able to review drafts, et cetera, and some of those were taken on. But in 2021, there was also the political declaration on HIV AIDS, where, you know, all the member states come together and pass the political declaration. So it was at the high level meeting on HIV/AIDS. But from that, what was passed were what are known as the 10-10-10 societal enabler targets. One of those 10s relates to decriminalization, including of drug use. So there was like decrim of drug use, decriminalization of sex work, decriminalization of sexual minorities and gender identity, and also decrim of HIV transmission, non-disclosure. So that was a big win, and that was the first time there is like a global target on decriminalization of drug use. But there are also the 80-60-30 targets, which is related to community-led responses. So recognizing the importance of community leadership and that it should be resourced within the global HIV response. So we were actually like invited to be on the 2025 target setting group. So I think it started like in 2019. So it's about a 2-year process. So we were like consulted on these targets. But then once we, you know, after 2021 had passed, we knew that we had these targets. They happened at the global level. But the next stage was, well, how do we, you know, kind of disseminate the knowledge that these targets exist, you know, to everywhere, right? Like at the national level, and, you know, needing to get that information to national advocates so they can hold their governments accountable. Because we know a lot of the time in global advocacy, you know, government representatives are there, it's closed discussion, there's not really much awareness of like what's being debated or discussed. So governments can make commitments there that then national, you know, people, citizens in their country don't know have actually been made. So this workshop is about doing like technical assistance and capacity building around these targets so people are aware of them, but also like to build advocacy skills and then also advocacy roadmaps or, you know, plans on what are the actions following the workshop to hold their governments accountable. They're very ambitious targets because it's supposed to be by 2025 that less than 10% of countries actually criminalize drug use and possession. So, but at least there's some, you know, it can be used for political momentum. So, yeah, we're doing these workshops in Indonesia, just happened. There's also going to be a regional workshop happening in the ECHA region, then also South Africa and Nigeria. So we are looking forward to working on that. Also going to be developing tools on legal assessment so that country advocates can, you know, map their not only like say drug policy laws, but also say their national strategic plan on HIV/AIDS, their health policies, and try to, you know, link them up more to some of the global commitments that were made, you know, in 2021.
That was my interview with Judy Chang, Executive Director of the International Network of People Who Use Drugs. Find them on the web at inpud.net. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.